Merkel Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tech Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the CS hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Iconic, Rockfin, Odyssey, or YouTube, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. It means a lot to us. If you enjoy this show, you can take the additional step of sharing it with your friends and family. That's how it grows, and we appreciate that, especially the help of our sponsors. We've got some new sponsors that have been on board lately. A company called Helin 951 reached out to me. They are making something that is fermented soy drink, which sounds a little weird and tastes a little funky, but it has some amazing health benefits. I took a look into it. I started asking people about it. I even asked Ken, the scientist, one of my sponsors with C60 Purple Power. I had lunch with him this last weekend and told him about this new sponsor. And he says, oh, man, that stuff is really good for you. He goes, but I don't think it tastes very good. I said, you're right. It does not taste very good. So, for those that are interested, I say, check it out. Just read up about it. Go to their website, Helin 951. It's spelled a little funky, so I'll spell it out for you. HAELAN, the numbers 951.com /macro. You can read up about it. That's the first step. Just try to understand it. I asked them about, I said, isn't soy bad for you? They said, no. You got to do a couple things. First of all, you've got to get a really good quality crop. You have to make sure it goes through the fermentation process, and it has to be done organic. It has to be grown organically. The problem with the United States is we have poor soil. We have lousy growing standards, and we use GMOs and pesticides, which is the reason why we have all these soy boys. So they grow their soybeans in this one region in Mongolia, which is crazy to me, but that's the place where it grows the best. So take a look, see if it's right for you. Helin 951, HAELAN951.com /macro. I'm going to put the links in the description so you don't have to memorize it unless you want to. And also, another one of our new sponsors, True Hemp Science. They're a small business based in Austin, Texas. They are making some great stuff. Hemp-based CBD oils. They sent me a line of products. I've been taking them now for maybe about 6 or 7 weeks. I feel great. All I ask, make my left shoulder not hurt anymore. Since I've been taking it, my shoulder doesn't hurt. I don't know how it works. I just know that it works. So if you are interested in checking them out as well, truehempscience.com /macroaggressions. They built us a nice little landing page. You can go and take a look. They have free shipping over $150, and they throw in lots of goodies. There's a little special going. They'll give you a free bottle of number 81 distillate if you buy $65 or more. So go take a look at the landing page. See if it's right for you. The stuff that I've been taking, number 19 and number 41, if you're interested. So go to truehempscience.com/macroaggressions and take a look. And of course, supporting our sponsors helps to support the show, and we appreciate that. Well, one of the great things about doing the Union of the Unwanted shows and having Ricky Verandas as a partner on that is that he knows all sorts of interesting people. And many times we've had group shows where our guest has been nice enough to stay up till the really late hours where he is in lovely Monaco, hedge fund manager, artificial intelligence expert, Alex Cranier. How are you, Alex? It's good to see you again.
My pleasure to be with you. Thank you for inviting me, and greetings to your listeners and the viewers.
Well, people can check out your stuff at thenakedhedgy.com. I don't think it's as X-rated as some people might believe. It has to do with the hedge fund background. Also, you put out a product called Trend Compass from Cranier Analytics. That's €1,000 a year. That helps people that want to... tell me a little bit about that, because I think people will be interested.
Basically, as a hedge fund manager, I'm a former hedge fund manager. I no longer manage money, but basically for 15 years, I've been a systematic trend follower, which means that you basically buy and sell securities and assets in function of trends. Basically, markets move in trends, which I think most people intuitively understand. They have noticed, you've seen the prices of gold, the prices of Bitcoin, stock prices, S&P 500, NASDAQ, Apple. All of these things are trends, meaning large-scale price events that span weeks and months and even years. And basically, systematic trend following basically amounts to tracking a large number of diversified markets, including commodities and financial futures. And basically, when you get a signal that something is trending up, you buy it. When you get a signal that something is trending down, you sell it. At the intuitive common sense level, that sounds very simple, but putting it in action is actually a little bit more complex. But all it requires actually is a good quality trend following model. And then it requires a lot of patience and discipline. So what I do today is I provide decision support for investors who want to apply systematic trend following in managing their portfolios. And that arrives by daily Trend Compass reports which I cover about 200 different markets.
Wow. There's a lot going on there. I mean, I think it's so complicated these days, and to try and figure out where things are going in the future, you have to understand where they might have been in the past, and that takes you down a rabbit hole of how true is the past? And you've been doing great work going back, looking at what was actually happening in the lead up to World War II. You talked about you've got these videos or a 45-minute video that's out, also a 3-part series that I'll put links to that in the description as well. Really fascinating about the way that World War II actually kicked off, and normally that's just it's just a history lesson if people are interested, but the difference now is that we're starting to see some patterns forming. We're starting to see decisions being made, rhetoric ramping up in certain regions of the world that are mimicking the things that started happening when World War II kicked off. And of course, we're not looking for World War III, but we're looking out onto the horizon to see what's coming. And if you start to see like you manage trends for a living, right? So you start to see a trend that looks similar to a trend that happened in the past. And in this particular case, let's take the financial component out of it. What we're just seeing is trends that are that sound like they're leading towards the pretext to a much bigger war. So in the past we had, we had the Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Poland sort of lead up to World War II, where they were negotiating. I don't even know if that's the right word, but they were negotiating the Sudetenland in the region of Czechoslovakia. They were giving up portions of this. And it seemed a little wonky to people on the outside. And through years of analysis, looking back on it, you can see that what was reported in the mainstream press and told to be the official story, very different behind the scenes. And now we're starting to see the same sorts of war drums beating, talking about Ukraine again and their relationship with Russia. And of course, the media is getting involved and they're being hysterical about this. What are the sort of things that you see playing out right now that are mimicking some of the previous signs that led us into a destructive world war?
Well, it's a big question, you know, and I see all kinds of things. Basically, you see that the tensions are escalating, and they have been for a long time, you know. Pretty much ever since Vladimir Putin came into power in Russia, the West realized that it was hoped that he would be cooperative, that he would be, you know, their guy. It didn't turn out that way. He turned out to be quite decisive in asserting Russia's sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And not a pushover of Western banking and corporate interests. So the West soured on him very, very quickly. So already in the early 2000s, you had, I think it was 2004 already, that a group of Western leaders and intellectuals, including people like John McCain and Madeleine Albright and so forth, wrote a letter, about 110 of people like this, wrote an open letter saying that Russia is becoming dangerous, that it is trying to rebuild the Soviet Empire, and that they are displaying this militaristic behavior and language and so forth. Well, you know, 15 years later, it has happened, but they still as an enemy, even though Russian conduct has not merited that. So, you know, Russia under Putin has consistently sought to find ways of cooperation with West, primarily with the United States. We can get into why that is, because that's another fascinating aspect to the whole story. However, the West, you know, the West kind of looks at everybody like, you either submit to our dictate, or we sanction you, we regime change you, we go to war against you.
Right.
And he has been pushing more for a cooperative treaties agreements among equals. So we acknowledge and accept your interests and security, but you also acknowledge and accept our interests and security. The West doesn't do that. You know, the West has, you know, when I say the West, you know, like we're talking about the United States and NATO, they say like, no, you do as we say or else, you know. And so this has led to a deterioration of relations between Russia and the West. Starting in 2012, the U.S. Congress enacted the so-called Magnitsky Act, which is something that might be obscure to most Americans because there's so much else going on as well. The Magnitsky Act is widely believed to be the opening salvo of the new Cold War. Mm. And so from 2012, we had another meaningful deterioration of relations slipping into Cold War. Then we had conflict over Syria, over Ukraine. And today we come to a head where, you know, we had this buildup of tension over the alleged buildup of Russian troops on Ukraine's borders. Now, this is another one of those Iraqi weapons of mass destruction stories. You know, they show you some satellite images and they say, aha, you see, Russians are building. You have no idea what you're looking at. You're looking at some satellite images. These troops are 100 to 300 kilometers away from the Ukraine's border. So there is no buildup. There is no evidence of a buildup. But it's good enough for the media to start again the war drums. And, you know, we have to go kill Russia now, you know, because otherwise, better fight them over there than fight them over here. You know, like the whole rhetoric starts all over again. What's different this time is that Russians have said, okay, enough. You're crossing our red lines. Our red line was that Ukraine does not enter NATO. Ukraine de facto has kind of become an appendage to NATO because it's receiving weaponry and training and mercenary troops from the West. So for Russia, this is over their red line. What happened is that the Russians have drafted two treaties. The main one between Russia and the United States, because they understand the United States as being the ringleader. And the other one, the sub-treaty, is between Russia and NATO. Okay. And these treaties are very, very tough. I mean, they're drafted in a very precise, well-structured way. So there's not much, you know, wiggle room to pretend that you didn't understand them, you know. And they gave the United States and NATO counterparts 1 month to respond. And they said, if you don't respond within 1 month, we're going to take care of it ourselves. Which is kind of, you know, turned the situation around. And now the ball is in Joe Biden administration's court. And not so much into NATO, because NATO, you know, the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, who is nothing but a sock puppet, he's already rejected the treaty. You know, he said, like, no, Russia has no place to ask us to agree to anything. You know, like, we do what we want and as we want it and when we want it. But, he's not the one running the show. So we are now within this period of 1 month countdown where either the United States is going to agree to the Russian treaty or they're going to say, we agree to this part. The others to meet and discuss and negotiate, which is already a step in the right direction, or we have to wait and see how Russians will respond to this. Now, the reason why I felt compelled to dig up the true history of appeasement of what happened in 1938 is because as these tensions have built up, certain war hawks and neocons on the US side who are dying to get some kind of a war going. You know, I think they're having withdrawal symptoms or something. They have started to ratchet up the rhetoric by invoking appeasement and the Munich Agreement in 1938. And basically, you know, to most people this doesn't mean very much. But if you remember your school curriculum, then basically the conclusion you would reach is, aha, Ukraine today is Czechoslovakia, the Donbass, the disputed region in Ukraine, is the Sudetenland, Vladimir Putin is Hitler, and if we appease him, we're going to have another Nazi Germany only coming from Russia this time around. So we have to go to war, or we have to at least in some way by force stop Vladimir Putin, or else we're going to have another Hitler on our hands. The analogy is completely wrong, and it's kind of either the people who are making this analogy are ignorant, or they're hoping that most people who hear this are ignorant. But I kind of felt compelled to try to present this, the truth of this history, because I grew up in Yugoslavia, in former Yugoslavia, right? And I lived through this buildup. And one of the things that impressed me tremendously is that I'm convinced that 99% of all of us living in the former Yugoslavia at that time, so I was 21 years old when the war broke out, 99% of us thought that there is no way we could have a war. You know, like, it was unthinkable. It was just something so completely out of mind that we just thought, like, okay, you know, like, so there's all these disagreements there, and but there's no way, you know, like, my parents are a mixed marriage. I'm Croatian, but my mother is Serbian, right? Her parents were mixed of Serbia and Slovenia. So you had this, the population was intertwined in a lot of ways, in families, culturally, in all sorts of ways. So that, you know, like, the idea that a neighbor could turn against neighbor, that community could turn against community, that we could all go to war was just completely unthinkable. Yet, once the shooting started, once there was the shooting war, the thing that happens that unless you live through it, you can't quite fathom, is that the psychology almost instantly changes. So now that there's a war going on, there's no more nuanced discussion about this and that. You know, like, everybody kind of closes ranks behind their leadership. You might not like Joe Biden today, but if the United States went to war against Russia, forget all that. You close ranks behind the leader you have. Questioning the leadership becomes unpatriotic. Nuanced discussion becomes tantamount to treason. And everything kind of boils down to black and white, us against them. And from that point on, it's war. People enlist, they go to war, and you have a big, huge mess that's very, very difficult to reverse. It's very, very difficult to reverse course. It takes such a powerful momentum that from that point on, there's no going back until a complete exhaustion and war fatigue sets in and a stalemate, and then you still have to talk to the other side and sign a peace, an armistice of some sort. So I think it's better to have that nuanced discussion now and to refuse this buildup to war, to reject it, than to just kind of complacently let it all happen. And then, you know, like, you have massive economic and social destruction on your hands and you have to rebuild from nothing. So anyway, that's the big long introduction into why I wrote that piece and put out the video that I did. But basically my effort was to try to raise awareness and hopefully contribute to a peaceful resolution of this conflict.
Well, yeah, that's what we would like. But unfortunately, we have some very dangerous people that want war. As you said, you've got Victoria Nuland, the you know, who has had it in for Ukraine for a while. She, of course, married to Kagan, who's one of the founders of the Project for a New American Century, not just a member, but one of the founders of it. So there's no mistaking where they're coming from. They're team war. They want war. They want chaos. They want all of that stuff. But and we, the American people, maybe not our audience here, but just in general, the public is so dumbed down and they don't know anything. You know, they turn on their television and they see what's going on and they hear about Russia. On our media, on the left-leaning media, MSNBC, you've got Rachel Maddow for years screaming about the very real, in her mind, potential of Russia deciding to refuse to sell gas to certain countries or to in fact cut off gas supplies to the United States in a way that would create chaos and would freeze out a large portion of the Northeast. I mean, just delusional fantasies that these people have of Russia as the boogeyman. Obviously, they're trying to influence our election. They put Donald Trump in office. They go through all of this. It gets exposed as being gigantic lies. They double down. They say, no, no, it's all true. We just can't tell you about it because it's secret. And you're like, okay. So we know that they want Russia. We know that they don't like Russia. I don't have a problem with Russia. In fact, I see some of the things that Vladimir Putin does and I laugh. I think, oh, well, he gets it. He says things. He doesn't seem like the boogeyman that the Western media would like to point out, but it's all about perception. So there's enough people in this country that believe that he is the next Hitler and that this Donbass Sudetenland connection is real, if they even remember their history. They somehow see they look at the pictures of Russian troops amassing on the Ukrainian border and they go, oh, look, it's just like, you know, it's just like the aluminum tubes. Aluminum tubes. Saddam has aluminum tubes. And everyone goes, oh my God, aluminum tubes. And they go, is that bad? You know, like it doesn't even mean anything. They're like, you know what he can use those aluminum tubes for? All kinds of things. You're like what? You're like things, you know, like bombs or missiles. They're like, maybe. So we don't even know anything. Like we're so dumbed down in the general public. But this idea, the craziest part of this, which, you know, if we were dealing with people that were rational and wanted what we wanted, I don't think that there would be this massive, there's paranoia about a potential war. But unfortunately, we live, at least here in the United States, in a society where war is seen as not a bad thing by the politicians, but as the perfect distraction away from their failings as legislators. So we have Biden and Kamala Harris, and I don't know however we want to define their presidency. It's weird and fake, and the ratings for this Biden television show are in the toilet. Nobody likes these people. There's a large segment that feels that they stole the election to begin with. There's no trust there, which makes me fear that the distraction might be coming. And what better distraction than another war? So we hear about war with China. We hear about that, but we also hear from time to time, depending on how much influence Israel is having, Iran. Is Iran a more realistic target for a distraction war than, say, a proxy war through Ukraine to fight Russia? Because that to me seems like the United States is coming off of a couple wars in which we got beat in Vietnam by farmers in sandals, and then we got beat in Afghanistan by sheep herders in sandals. I don't know if we want any piece of Russia. And yet, so it makes me think that maybe that is a bit of a distraction. Is Iran, not that Iran is to be taken lightly, to be crystal clear, but is Iran a more realistic distraction for a war than, say, Ukraine/Russia?
Well, I think the problem is, you know, I think it's mistaken to look at the United States as a monolith. I mean, you appreciate that, I'm sure. So you have all these interest groups who are vying for control, who have their pet projects and their pet interests. And I'm sure that there are Israeli lobbyists who would love for the U.S. to go and kill Iran for them. Mm-hmm. And then there are the neocons who would love for the U.S. military to go kill Russia for them. And then there are other interests who would love for them to go and kill China for them. And so I think that they're all vying for influence to try to pull the power and the wealth of the United States towards their own pet project. None of these options look very, very good for the U.S. military. First of all, the U.S. military is already very, very severely war fatigued. I think that the morale, you know, you never advertise this, but the morale is pretty low. And I think that this this last thing with the vaccine mandates didn't help either. No. I think that the whole pandemic thing has brought out into the open a lot of problems, a lot of incoherences of the whole system that you start, you know, and you know, like then once you start seeing things and questioning them, you can't unsee them. And so now the whole, you know, gung-ho, let's go spread freedom and democracy around the world morale that maybe you had 20 years ago when the United States first went into Iraq and Afghanistan, I think that moment is gone. And so now to build a new case for war against either Russia or China or Iran is going to be very difficult, you know. And you know, like you can try to orchestrate a war, but what if nobody turns up to fight? What if nobody wants to fight it?
Right.
You're like, what do you do? So this is, you know, like this has seriously led me to wonder if they, you know, the they. Mm-hmm. If they, because, you know, like if you read 1984, the society is always at war.
Right.
Except that it's never clear that they're really at war. You know, there's these reports about these battles, and but nobody really knows that these wars are real. And then they seamlessly kind of switch where you're at war against East Asia. And then all of a sudden, you're at war against Eurasia. But nobody really knows, because all they know is what is reported to them. And what's reported to them is, you know, could be completely invented out of whole cloth.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, you know, war against China probably can't seem very attractive to the U.S. military, which would have to go and fight it. War against Russia, even less so. War against Iran, you know, maybe that might be the smallest, most vulnerable target. But, you know, like once you got beat by the sheep herders in sandals in Afghanistan, do you really want to take on Iran, which has been kind of preparing for this for more than 20 years now? They've seen the writings on the wall. You know, they've seen that there was this neocon strategy of taking out 7 countries in 5 years.
Right.
And Iran knew that they were one of the target countries. So probably the whole country is booby-trapped against this happening, you know. So whoever goes there is going to get a bloodied nose.
Yeah.
So, you know, orchestrating a war is going to be very, very difficult for them. If there was no internet, if they could just like do state propaganda like they did in the Soviet Union, maybe you'd be fighting fake wars against Iran or Russia. Yes. Or just to keep everybody you know, kind of motivated and awake.
Yeah.
But I honestly don't know. I don't think there's a winnable war anywhere on the horizon. But you know, like as we also learned in the last 20 years, from the point of view of the people at the top of the hierarchy in our societies, winning a war is not that important. Keeping the war going is much more important.
Right.
The danger, as I see it, and this, you know, like I wrote it in an article about a year ago. I wrote an article titled COVID-19, The Banking Cartel is Driving the Agenda. And I could see that the agenda was far too complex, far too ambitious to succeed, that the wheels were already starting to come off, and that they would need a big distraction at some point. And that probably the choice distraction would be war. And that as this pandemic agenda starts to fail, that they would do their utmost to try to orchestrate a war. And so now we're at that stage. The danger, if the war gets going, you know, as I told you, suddenly the social psyche polarizes. It's us against them. You close ranks behind your leadership. And that makes it very easy for the leadership to do away with opposition. You know, like people like Joe Rogan, Tucker Carlson, Jimmy Dore, they vanish off air, and maybe they vanish, you know, maybe they'd be spending the rest of their lives in some detention camp somewhere.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff really happens. You know, people shouldn't think that this is like, this only happens in black and white. This can happen today as well. Yeah. So that would be a very, very important reason to avoid war. And I also doubt that they could orchestrate a fake one, because they would have to take down the internet. They would have to completely cut people off from independent sources of information. So long story short, I don't see how they will succeed. I don't see how they will succeed, but at the same time, it will not be enough for them to fail. I think that we have to come up with credible, workable alternatives. You know, how to organize a society.
Right.
And, you know, I think that the core problem is money. Because everything emanates from the monetary system. It's like the source that contaminates everything else. Mm-hmm. The social relationships, the family relationship, it predicates corruption in the system. It predicates malinvestment, war. You know, war. If the monetary system wasn't organized the way it was, we wouldn't be in this permanent war. Situation. So the main problem that we have to resolve is the monetary system. And, you know, fortunately now with the internet, we've learned so much about this. You know, like I had no idea 20 years ago when I came out of the university, I knew what they taught me there. I had no idea. But, you know, like there's so many resources out there. We can learn, and we can, you know, we can do a lot better than this.
Well, I was going to say, we are in a war. It's a currency war. It's a war of the banking war against us. They've been inflating our money supply here, at least the Federal Reserve with the US dollar. They've been using that as a weapon, debt as a weapon. The IMF and World Bank have been using that against smaller countries to club them into submission. And so we've got this new... So the central banks are obviously the enemy. They see the people as their enemy, and we fight against each other. But now, come in the coming year, 2022, the rise of the CBDC, the central bank digital currency, and the potential that these maniacs, central bankers, have to program the money supply, to take it from being dumb money, just a piece of paper with ink on it, to have it be programmable, to have it be manipulated on a level, on a, you know, so that it can function much differently. We have the opportunity. Now, if we were in charge of a central banking digital programmable currency, I don't think we would set it to be evil, but we know that the people that are in charge of it are most definitely not on our side. So I envision a future in which these digital programmable currencies are set to do all kinds of crazy things. Like maybe they only work on the company store. They only work, say, at Amazon or Walmart or wherever. You're only issued these coins or these, let's just call them like Fed coin as an example. You're only issued the Fed coin if your social credit score is high enough, if your vaccine compliance is fully met, things like that. They could set these currencies to expire. Let's say they have a bad Christmas and, you know, sales are down and we need to ramp up spending. Well, we've just set it so that a percentage of the coins that you have are all going to expire in 90 days. And so that causes people to start spending, and that increases the money velocity, and it makes it look good in the short term. And then the politicians can say, hey, look, sales are up 30%, reelect me. And all of this stuff, just I have this vision for what these people can do. What you work in this industry, you did through the hedge fund. You have a deep understanding of artificial intelligence. And you said something interesting when you were on one of our last Union of the Unwanted shows, which was that luckily artificial intelligence is extremely difficult, and that all of these things that they talk about in the future, AI will do this. You said that like 90% of them aren't going to actually happen because it's too complicated. Talk a little bit about that, about this. I mean, it might be actually the best news we hear is that AI is not set up to be this all-knowing, all-powerful system, at least not in its current form, right?
Yeah. So based on my experience, and I really did go deep into AI research. My trend following model is a form of AI, yeah, enough for me to get a very clear understanding of what we're doing and what we're dealing with. So basically, you know, computers are very powerful, but they're extremely dumb. You know, I don't know. To give you an example, for years they were talking about self-driving cars. And the first time I heard self-driving cars, I said, like, dude, that's never going to happen. Forget it. That is never going to happen. I can bet you any amount of money and you can go 100 years in the future and it's still not going to be working. And I'll explain why. Okay, so for example, you can see what this is. It's a pen, right?
Yeah.
And that's also the pen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that too. And that is also a pen, right? To you, this is clear as day. To computer, this is very different from this,
mm-hmm,
which is very different from this. And so for one object, you would have to, you know, like you have to define every single thing. You can't expect a computer to know the difference between this and this.
Right.
You have to code it. So for a self-driving car, a child, a dog, a rabbit, a piece of trash, a bag being flown in the wind, all of that has to be somehow defined precisely, not like, oh yeah, if you see a plastic bag, don't worry about it. But if you see a child, slow down.
Mm-hmm.
It can be vague. It has to be extremely precise. That's a lot of code. Professional software programmers, on average, make between 100 and 150 errors per 1,000. I read somewhere running its various systems. Okay, so there's always going to be a lot of error. So you're always going to have to do maintenance. Maintenance on software system is extremely difficult. Why? Because you're looking at this code, which is not like prose. You know, reading software code is a skill.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a year to acquire this skill to become fluent enough that you can read through the code and say like, aha, yeah, this. So it is enough for a developer not to document his code or her code correctly, meaning that, you know, like you write a routine and then you have to write in English, in your language, you have to write in this routine does this. It talks to these other routines and the, you know, like information comes from there and the results go there. So all of this has to be, it's very meticulous, fastidious work. If you want to build a software system that's reliable, that's maintainable, and that always works. And we didn't even touch on the databases. So you know, like all these self-driving cars, they would have to have very extensive databases of what they've encountered, mm-hmm, what they would be having to learn from. All of that would have to work flawlessly 100% of the time. When was the last time your computer worked flawlessly 100% of the time? So, you know how it is with software, you know, you install stuff and it doesn't. So, you know, it's because we've built complexity on top of more complexity on top of more complexity. It's getting more and more difficult to make these very advanced, sophisticated system to talk to each other and to not make mistakes. And then you'd have to have all the sensors working 100% of the time flawlessly. Well, you know, like if some dirt, some mud goes on your sensor, then what happens? So it's not going to happen. When you go to the CBDCs, again, you know, like, I don't know if you ever saw, I received once a readout of the information that your mobile phone generates about you. It's fascinating because it literally makes this text that says like, walked 5 minutes, 200 meters to that place, there 30 minutes, then drove to, you know, like it's very exhaustive. Mm-hmm. It's amazingly precise. Okay. So now, you know, the fantasies of the people who think that they will control all humanity is obviously they cannot go through all of our movements, but the fantasy is that they're going to have all these AI algorithms that are going to say like, aha, Charlie Robinson had, you know, 10 ounces of red meat this week. So next time he orders red meat, do not allow him to make that order. Do not allow him to pay for that. You know, block his account. That, you know, like they fantasize that they will be able to micromanage by virtue of AI. Mm-hmm. Again, where are you going to find the engineers to write up all these algorithms, to maintain them, to make sure that they're all working nonstop? And then, you know, there's also the option, as long as humanity has existed, if the ruling elites, or parasites, I prefer to call them, become too oppressive, what people do is they turn to gray and black markets. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like if you're not allowed to buy your red meat for your CBDC from your CBDC account, well, maybe you'll go to the butcher and you give him like an ounce of silver and say like, hey, you know, keep me some meat for next week.
Right.
And he's going to say like, hey, cool, you'll have that meat. And now there's a transaction that they have no control over. So all these systems that they're building in delusion that they will be able to shut off all the escape routes is, I don't know. I really reached the decision that people who are in charge are not too bright, that they're really beset by incredibly thick delusions, and they're pushing in a direction that's hopeless. And so, you know, CDBCs are not ready. Sorry, CBDCs are not ready. When they come out ready, they're going to be very clunky. I think that the effect will be to push a large segment of human interactions and transactions onto the gray and black markets. And that will invite more repression, because then they will have to, okay, now what? Now we have to go out and punish everybody who bought their red meat for silver dollars, you know? So that means that you have to, again, anyway, the whole, you know, like you have to invest in police, you have to create this Stasi, KGB, secret police nightmare. And everybody who's tried this in history has failed, because eventually, you know, people don't tolerate it anymore. Even people who are in charge of enforcing it get fatigued. You know, like it's not like go out and bust people for buying red meat for. So ultimately they will fail with everything they're doing. But the problem is that in the meantime, they're going to cause a lot of damage to a lot of us.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely, I think, something that everyone can agree. It's actually good news. It's good news to hear that their plans are a bit too ambitious. We know they're dopey people. I mean, we know that the politicians that deliver the messages are barely capable of human interaction. They're morons of the highest order. But the people above them, those are the ones that make us really scared. And one of the things that they're doing, be this the World Economic Forum Davos crowd or the unelected bureaucrats. Just saw this in Zero Hedge talking about them. They're running a simulation simulating the banking system going down for 10 days and what they can do to. So it was Israel, it was several countries, Western countries. But along with the IMF, the World Bank, and BIS, and they were simulating this takedown of the grid, of the system, of the banking system, and what the messaging would be. And when I see those people getting together and doing these simulations, I immediately go to my mental checklist of all the other simulations that have gone live, and I get very nervous. Or what do you think these people are planning? Do you think they are actually planning for a temporary takedown to see how things go? Would that benefit them? I know that it would create a ton of chaos, but. Are they sort of, is this an order out of chaos type of situation for them?
Yeah, I think it may well be. You know, I think that they always, by creating emergencies and these big problems for society, they then give themselves the latitude to step in with their own solutions, you know, to say like, okay, you know, now we have to, you know, now everybody has to stay home and lock down, you know, like with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So that wouldn't surprise me. I think that for the people, it will be important to try to always keep some cash on hand.
Yeah.
You know, like at least 2 weeks, a month of worth of expenses so that, you know, you can buy your supplies, because, you know, we've seen this happen in Cyprus in 2009,
right.
2010. You know, like where people couldn't get to their money, and you had these like really, really long lines at the ATMs, and they were rationed by, you know, like 100 euros a person, and people were getting fights. And so, you know, to avoid all this, it would be good to always have some cash on hand just in case that you don't have to, you know, find yourself unable to buy your groceries and stuff like that. I'm sure that they will be trying more and more of these sabotages that will allow them to further clamp down, to further impose these emergency rules that, you know, basically you have to do as they say, because otherwise you're putting other people in danger, you're unhelping the society, you're a sociopath and so forth. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I see Klaus Schwab, he doesn't miss a chance to say how this whole thing with the pandemic was nothing compared to what would happen if we had the cyber attack. You know, he keeps right. talking about cyber attacks, which tells me that they're probably planning one. Yeah. I have no idea what this will mean, other than that probably one day we probably won't be able to log on to the internet and go and bitch and complain about things on Facebook.
Right.
but for some people, it'll be a real problem, because maybe you won't be able to get money out of your bank, or who knows, you know, it's hard to say.
Yeah. Well, this actually kind of sort of as a byproduct of this, what is your take on physical gold and silver? As somebody that you manage trends, you look at that as a hedge against this, against central bank digital currencies or problems with the internet, and we do still have this old barbarous relic of gold and the massively price suppressed silver. What are your thoughts on those assets?
Well, my thoughts on those assets are very, very favorable. You know, like I think that everybody should have some gold and silver bullion on hand. I don't advise people to go overboard, because it can become its own mind trap. You know, that you think like, oh, I have to, you know, like hoard as much as possible. No, I think that you need to have probably at the maximum 3 to 6 months worth of your life's expenses. Which, believe me, in an inflation will become much less in terms of real assets, you know. So price of gold is going to appreciate. Life is going to become much cheaper in the real terms. So I think that what you want to have is to give yourself a window of time to transition to a new, different economy, you know, an environment where people are going to start to help themselves and each other more, become self-sufficient to a higher degree. You know, like it's an illusion to think of self-sufficiency as like one nuclear family or one individual who just like, you know, has his gun and his land and he has everything there, because that's hugely onerous. But where you have like maybe 100 to 150 households, that community can be completely self-sufficient for an indefinite period of time, you know, because in 150 households, you'll have doctors, dentists, you'll have engineers, you'll have car mechanics, people who grow food, people who can fix shoes, stuff like that. You know, this is what you need. You can't do it all on your own, and you can't do it all within a nuclear family. But, you know, that transition requires a little bit of time.
Yeah.
And for that window of time, which I would say like maybe 6 months, give it 12 months. For that period of time, you want to have maybe some gold and silver coins. And I would say to people, go for coins. Don't buy those little tablets, because nowadays they make them fake, you know?
Right.
There's like a layer of gold, and inside there's like, I don't know what, tungsten. Or
tungsten.
They've improved faking technology as well. So I haven't kept up, but apparently, you know, there's all kinds of stuff. And then you also don't want to be in a situation that you pay that you pay a dozen eggs, you know, $5,000, you know. So
right.
I think, you know, you want to go with small denomination coin if it's possible. And then silver is always smaller denomination than gold. But anyway, you know, I think that the real transition would be to try to cultivate mutual support within communities, and to try to become self-sufficient to a higher degree. You know, you're never going to be completely self-sufficient, but to a higher degree, let's say, where you know, like if the Walmart down the street shuts down, you're not in a food desert, you know,
right?
Which many parts of the United States are food desert. You know, like I was married. I used to be married to my ex-wife is American, mm-hmm. and we would go and visit her family in South Carolina. And there was just like 5 miles down the road, there was a Walmart, and then nothing.
Right.
I felt like, well, if that Walmart shut down, you people will be in trouble. And, you know, so then instead of having golf course, maybe you need like a vegetable garden and a chicken shed and, you know, actually useful things.
Yeah. Well, they've tried to get us away from that. They want us in this just-in-time supply chain dependency where if they so choose, they turn off the cargo ships or they turn off the trucks and then what? So I don't trust these people at all. Let's wrap up with this last thing. This is kind of a hybrid of it all, but how do you see crypto playing into this? Not the evil CBDC crypto, but, and I realize that crypto spans a broad, you know, there's a lot going on there. It's not just Bitcoin, but also there's thousands of coins out there. But how do you see the role of cryptocurrencies in this sort of, the new, I don't know, the new environment that we're moving into, the digital world?
I don't know. This has been kind of on my radar since about 2013. Mm-hmm. I still can't make up my mind, you know, like I understand the value of the blockchain technology. It's a phenomenal thing, but you know, most of these cryptocurrencies are first of all, they're never gonna become a real medium of exchange. You know, they've attracted mostly speculation, because people see them not as a means of exchange, but as an investment security where they're gonna, you know, turn $1,000 into $100,000, you know, they're going to just get all this money. The problem is that if the federal, if the central banks are successful with the introduction of cryptocurrency, CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, that will kill the cryptos. Okay. Because now all of a sudden, basically what they do, they would make their new currency the legal tender. And they would demand payment of taxes in that legal tender. Mm-hmm. So now you would always have to have their CBDCs. You couldn't reject them entirely. And so even if you used Bitcoin or whatever other cryptocurrencies, in order to pay your taxes, you would still have to convert it to the legal tender currency. And at that point, you would have to disclose your holding of your cryptocurrencies, right? Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, the government can say like, okay, well, now, you know, every time you convert your currency into the into our currency, you're going to pay this much tax. You know, they could just kill the whole thing. And so I think that we shouldn't dismiss cryptocurrencies, but they need to become the mainstream means of exchange rather than a security for speculation.
Right.
So when you can go and buy your groceries in some cryptocurrency and get your change, or, you know, whatever, you know, sell your things and buy things from others, I would be cautious. I think that I think that the right approach would be to be a bit agnostic about it, you know, because it is a tremendously useful technology. Whether it will be able to withstand the repression from the authorities, I don't know. My approach has always been diversification. So maybe you want to have a little bit of gold and a little bit of silver. Maybe you want to have even a small plot of land that can be converted to growing whatever vegetables or, you know, crops. Have a little bit of crypto if you're comfortable with it, or to the extent that you're comfortable. You know, have a few guns.
Right. Yeah.
But basically, you know, try to have a few useful alternatives. And then also, you know, the crypto is not the only thing. People have, you know, like when 100 years ago, when Germany had their hyperinflationary episode in the Weimar Republic, you know, the alternative currencies started popping up like mushrooms all over the place. You know, they had local and regional currencies where people just needed some kind of a means of exchange to be able to exchange goods and services. And so these things happen quickly. And so even simpler, not very high tech, but simpler types of regional and local currencies, or even time banks. Time banks are very, very useful to facilitate exchange of services and goods between people locally. You know, so there's all these solutions. People are resilient. People are smart. You know, they can only be misled so far. Some people can be misled all the way. You know, you always have screeching zealots in the population. Yeah. But otherwise, you know, like you have you know, people are intelligent, and when they wake up, they realize, you know, the shit hit the fan, and we have to work out other things. They help one another, and that's all to be welcomed. And so I'm not pessimistic. I think that just the transition period might be, at some point, it might get ugly.
Yeah.
And people have to be ready for that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just the reality of things. Whenever you change from one system to the other, some people are going to adapt quicker. Some people will benefit from it. They'll be able to really position themselves to take advantage of it. Others will be left kicking and screaming, dragged into the new economy. So I guess it's all about preparation. It's about trying to see out into the future. That's one of the things that you do. Tell everyone where they can find access to your reports, where they can maybe get a little bit of a view of what's coming their way.
Sure. So my personal blog is The Naked Hedgie, just simply thenakedhedgie.com, one word, where I tackle a broader range of issues. I have a professional website called iSystem Trend Following. So the website is iSystem-tf.com. And on Twitter, I'm at Naked Hedgie. I just wanted to add this bit because I think it's appropriate to finish it on optimistic note, because I think that the future that people are going to discover is going to be like you lived your whole life with a leech attached to you, draining your substance and your energy and your mood. And this leech is coming off, and people are suddenly going to discover a better way of living. They're going to discover that the world is not scarce, but abundant. And they're going to start to discover that abundance. We have to defend freedom. Unfortunately, that has to be done resolutely and with firmness. But in freedom, we're going to live a much, much better, leave a much, much better world to our children. And so it may seem like a fantasy, like a utopia now, but I think it's not an illusion. I think it's real. We're born into a world of abundance, and the scarcity has been created artificially. We all have these energy substance leeches attached to us through the system within which we're forced to operate. But once this system falls, finally, people were going to breathe with full lungs again.
I feel like I got the name for this episode from the last minute of this conversation. Okay. The leeches of society from us. That's Alex Cranier, everybody. He's the best. If you're interested, I'm going to have all the links to his websites and to his businesses in the description below. And if you like this episode, take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. Thank you, Alex, for everything that you do. We appreciate your work. And
thank you very much. It was a great pleasure. And, greetings to your listeners and viewers again, and upwards and onwards. I think that the future is bright.
I do too. I think that we'll leave it there. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you soon.